Bibles to the book of Genesis. We got some notes coming out. We'll be looking at the line of Shem today and moving out of chapter 10 into chapter 11, the Tower of Babel. A couple of things we want to take a look at is, well, I want to mention here today before we get started is, well, Tony's birthday. What's wrong? We'll pop it out of the bottom. Excuse me. I got an email from Jan and George from Australia that, well, we were offline for a while, and Jan emailed, wanted to know where we were, why we weren't online. She said she needs to listen to us three times a week, so she listens to all three of our messages. And she said that she heard on one of the CDs that I mentioned that, or online, that our price of gas was $4 a gallon. So she did so. She buys it by the liter. I don't know, it's $1.70 or something a liter. But she figured it out that they're paying almost $8 a gallon for gas in Australia. She says so. She says make sure you enjoy it at just under $4 a gallon. I've done some things on the website that I've been working on. James does a great job. Bye, James. Does a great job on keeping our audio and video online for us. We use his server. But what I've done this last week, I've had different study things that I see on other websites. I'll grab off and put a link to it on our website. And one thing I've done this last week is I've created a page. It's a study page or study helps page. You maybe find it there on the home page. You got a little graphic to click on. But there are some great, great things online as far as Bible translations, concordances, commentaries. Have this really cool little screen that you can type in any verse and it pops it up in Greek for you, which I know you all read Greek. But if you hold your mouse or cursor over that word, it tells you, highlights in the bottom there, it tells you the definition, the past tense, you know, whatever, the tense or mood of the verbs or the definitions of the nouns, all kinds of things like this, just right there online. It's, you know, you could pay $350 for some of these things and buy a Bible program or just get it online. So what I've been doing is just going through and scouring other websites. If there's something useful on another website, I just cut and paste it onto my website. So that's kind of neat. I kind of like that. So anyway, take a look at that. And if you have any other ideas, you see any things that you might want to look at, send me an email. I'll try and hook up with it. There is one neat little thing there. You can click on it. It runs a 90-second little video, and it shows you all the empires of the world, where they come and rise, fall, what other empires take over. It shows you the whole history of the world in about 90 seconds. And what it ends, what's real interesting, kind of ties into our story today, is that at the end it shows you the city of Jerusalem and the city of Baghdad, or in the Babylonian area of Baghdad, say. Puts those two cities on there. And as every empire rises or falls, those two cities are in the center from the beginning of the Egyptian Empire all the way. You know, there's something going on in those two cities all the way through history, which is kind of interesting. Oh, there's a lot of other things there that are fun to look at. Yeah, today's Tony's birthday, so what we've got planned is I'm going to take her out. We're going to go somewhere. We're still kind of figuring out what we're doing. You know, there's no surprise coming. It's like, well, maybe he's going to surprise her. No. But we'll go somewhere and do something this afternoon. But then I think we told the boys to plan a party for about 8 o'clock tonight, surprise party, and start inviting all their friends. So when we come home, it'll be a house full of high school kids playing video games and playing loud music, and Tony can celebrate. Because like I said, she is, you know, whatever age she is, she's very, very close to 50. She can say 40 all she wants to, but it's if you're a mathematician, you round up. In fact, we were talking last week at one of the graduations with her mom, that her mom was saying that her kids are almost half of them are almost senior citizens. Kind of made her mom feel better. Or old, I'm not sure. But anyway, anything else we want to say? Everybody's happy? Okay. What's that? Yeah. Hawkeye bought a business. Hawkeye's bought a tropical snow. So if you're ever in West Des Moines, find a little tropical snow stand, and friendly Hawkeye will get you a snow cone. Free? No, he's a businessman. He's not in the ministry. He's a businessman. But there will be free books and CDs on the counter. You can believe that. Yeah, one way or another. All right, Genesis chapter 11, chapter 10. You go online, you type this in, try and find a commentator that's covered this. It goes chapter 6, 7, 8, 12. They get right on past this stuff. But I'm not that smart. We're going to plow through it. This is interesting, though. You've got your notes there on that first page. You've got now the line of Shem. We've looked at Japheth, we've looked at Ham, and now we come to Shem. And Shem is going to have five sons that are going to be listed. You can see them on the top there: Elam, Asher, Arphaxad, Lud, and Aram. Aram is going to have four sons listed there, and that's basically going to become the Syrian people, the people that live in the Syria or just north of Israel. Aram, that's where Haran's at. They're continually interacting with the Israelites during the Bible times. But Arphaxad is really gives us a greater definition or a bigger listing of who they are. There's two, or a son of Arphaxad, Shelah, is listed. Shelah has a son named Eber, who then is listed with two sons, Peleg and Joktan. Now, Peleg, what's interesting about this now is from Peleg, he doesn't give us in chapter 10 any more definition or any further on the genealogy. He just leaves us at Peleg and tells us in his day the land was divided, or the earth was divided in Peleg's day. We'll talk about that a little bit. But if we continue over into chapter 11, if you got your Bibles there, just flip over to chapter 11, looking in verse 10. And we're not going to get there. We're going to pick this up next week. But it talks about, this is the account of Shem. And it gives you the people of the line of Shem. And they come out of here in chapter 11. They go on down through from Shem. They go to a guy named Reu, Serug, Nahor, Teran, and Abram. In other words, beginning in chapter 11, verse 10, after the story of Tower of Babel, we actually pick up with Peleg's line, and it comes up and leads us up to the line of Abram, or Abraham. Today, as we look at it, going back to chapter 10, beginning in chapter verse 21, it says, the sons were also born to Shem, whose older brother was Japheth. Shem was the ancestor of all the sons of Eber. And then we begin the genealogy that we have on this sheet of paper. It just lists the name of Peleg and leaves it sitting until later in chapter 11. But it gives you a detailed description of Joktan going up through all those names that you see there. 13 sons are listed. 13 names are given. They're mainly, I mean, we're going to look at a map here in just a moment. Those 13 sons, we're not going to go through every name of them. We'll maybe just breeze through them. But basically, they are in the Arabian Peninsula. They would be in the place south of Israel, down on the Arabian Peninsula, going down to Yemen and Saudi Arabia today. That is where they settled. And what ends up taking place, when that ends in chapter 10, verse 32, these are the clans of Noah's sons, according to their lines, the descendant lines of descent with their nations. From these, the nations spread out over the earth after the flood. Then we go to chapter 11, and it gives you the story of the Tower of Babel, which, as we look at the story of the Tower of Babel, it is not a story about a tower. Look right here. In verse 4 of chapter 11. Then they said, come, let us build ourselves a what? A city with a tower. And then later on it mentions it drops the city, but just mentions the tower. So the city's mentioned with a tower. Then later on it just mentions the tower. Meaning, the purpose of the tower was the city. Without a city, there's no need for a tower. It's a tower that is going to be some kind of a ziggurat. It's going to be some kind of fortification. It's going to be a lookout tower, military, whatever. But it's going to be a tower. It's going to be part of the center of the city. And without the city, there'd be no tower. So really, the Tower of Babel is not about just the tower, although that's the focus. The story of the Tower of Babel is about a city that the people were building. They were building a city, uniting themselves so they could control their own destinies. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But so after Joktan, we get on talking about Eber. So you've got this guy named Eber. And Eber is going to have two sons, Joktan and Peleg. It just mentions Peleg in Genesis chapter 10 and leaves it, says, in his day the earth was divided, or the land was divided. Then it gives you Joktan and gives you 13 sons that headed down to Saudi Arabia, Yemen, down in that part of the Saudi Arabia. But that leads into the story of the Tower of Babel. After you, then in chapter 11, we begin talking about the account of Shem through Peleg, and that leads right up to Abraham, and that rest of the book of Genesis is about the family of Abraham. So in other words, what you have here, when it divides from Eber, you go to Joktan and the story of Babel, and then you come and you go to Eber's other son, Peleg, and that leads into Abraham. So in other words, what you have here is very important, and sometimes we miss it because it's chapter 10, 11, and 12. It's kind of stretched out. What you have here coming out of Shem through Eber is the two stories of human history. The story of Babel, humanity, world, their own ideas against God. God is against them. And the story of Abraham, or the man of faith. And so you've got Eber coming down with Joktan and the Tower of Babel, Eber and the story of his other son, Peleg, and the story of Abraham. It's a matter of the world versus faith. It's a matter of Babel versus Jerusalem, or in our case today, the powers of the eastern world going as far as Baghdad, Babylon, going all the way to the book of Revelation, coming against Jerusalem. That begins right here. In fact, if we get a chance, if it all works together, we could flip over to Revelation and read about, guess what? The final chapters recorded in the Bible are about the city of Babylon being built and then being ultimately overthrown. So in other words, what takes place in chapter 10, where God is going to come and confuse chapter 10, they will not be able to finish building the city and they're scattered. By the time human history wraps up and we're in the final days of human history, guess what? They are on that place of they have built Babylon and they are now ruling the world or attempting to rule the world from Babylon. What God stopped in chapter 11 is going to continue to be a stress point until finally it is allowed to take place in Revelation and then ultimately is overthrown. Well, let's take a look here. If you want to turn the page very quickly, and you may want to be looking at the back page of these notes. There's a map there at the same time as we go through this. It's the same map you've seen, but this time you're going to have the line of Shem on here. Remember, Japheth moved up north. Ham was kind of in the middle, moving into Egypt or Africa. Now you've got Shem, who's still in the middle, moving to the east and to the south. And I remind you that in the center there, around Asher, the Tigris-Euphrates River, even up in Asia Minor, Turkey, you've got the overlap of Japheth, Ham, and Shem all living in those same areas there. Now, some of these people are going to begin, like for example, the people settling in Elam are going to be descendants of Shem, but it appears they're driven out by Ham, and they're actually driven to the east, and Ham is going to take over in certain areas there, because there is some overlap as these people have to either intermarry or conquer each other and work through this. So let's go here to chapter 10. This won't take long, I hope. Chapter 10, verse 21. Sons were born to Shem, whose older brother was Japheth. Shem was the ancestor of all the sons of Eber. Two things in this verse we want to look at. It says Japheth was the older brother. That's what the NIV says. That's what modern translators translate out of the scriptures or commentators get. And that is what the Jews believe, that Japheth was the older brother. It is possible to read that as some translations, older English translations have it as being Shem was the older brother. So really, either way you go, it's not like clear-cut who was the older brother. The formula that people say is Shem, Ham, and Japheth. That's the way it's said. That's the way it's recorded in the Bible. In Genesis 5, 6, 7, 9, 10, and in 1 Chronicles chapter 1, it is Shem, Ham, and Japheth. There's three sons. Shem is clearly going to be, however you slice and dice it, Shem is the one who is the privileged and the chosen son that gets the blessing. Shem. Ham is the one who's set aside, or the one who loses his position. And then following that is Japheth, is the one whose territory is expanded, or is the one who, in a sense, is the eldest. So Japheth, in a sense, gets the eldest portion, Shem gets the favored position, and Ham ends up being disqualified. That's how that is worked out. That's mentioned there. But it also says at the end of that verse, Shem was the ancestor of all of the sons of Eber, which is like, who cares? Who's Eber? Well, he's a guy named Eber, but the interesting thing about that is the word where we get the word or the name Hebrew, or the Eberites. You know, you got the Canaanites, the different Hittites, the Hivites. The Eberites are the Hebrews. And Abraham is going to be an Eberite, or a Hebrew. And so when it says that right there, Shem was the ancestor of all the sons of Eber, or all the sons of the Hebrews. And that they're going to, again, as we get to this, they're going to break down. Eber's going to have two sons, Peleg and Joktan. Joktan is going to possibly be the part of the involvement at Babel along with Nimrod. But Peleg is going to be the one who leads on into and receives, continues the blessing of Shem. There you've got the four sons listed there, or five sons, Elam, Ashur, Arphaxad, Lud, and Aram. You got those listed on page 2 very quickly. Elam. If you look on the map, Elam is going to be down towards the Persian Gulf. It's going to be on the east side of the Tigris-Euphrates River. It is interesting that Elam is one of the kings of Elam. Elam is going to come and fight against the land of where Abraham, the Canaanites, when Abraham fights later on in chapter 14 and 15. We're going to see Abraham engaged in a military conflict. I'm looking forward to getting to those chapters, and so are you, I know. But Abraham is going to defeat one of the kings from Elam who comes over along with three other kings from that area of Shinar, including the king of Shinar. So Abraham is going to be not just an old man riding around on a camel. He's going to be you got to start thinking about Abraham even before we get there. He is a sheik. He is a wealthy man. He is a man that has a standing army. So that when his country is invaded, he doesn't ask for governmental help. It says he loads up 315 men trained in his own household and goes after four kings who are in a coalition of kings or a coalition of nations who have come against the land of Canaan and have defeated five kings in the land of Canaan. Abraham goes out with his own men and defeats them and brings back all of the plunder. So as we're putting this together, when it says Elam, just keep in mind, the king of Elam is going to be defeated by Abraham and his own household. Not Abraham's country, Abraham. Very interesting. But going on there about Elam, some other things about Elam. They were originally, even their language that settled there, that came out of that, was not a Shemite language. It was a language that comes from Ham. And so at first they said, this isn't right, but because this isn't the people who settled there. But as we look at that, archaeologists have now concluded that the first settlers in land of Elam were from the line of Shem, and that they apparently moved out and were overtaken by the descendants of Ham. And thus, that's why it looks like Ham settled there instead of Shem. But Shem was there, or Elam was there first. The next one, Ashur, is mentioned. You can see Ashur up there. This is another son of Shem. Ashur is where we get the word Assyrian. That's the Assyrians are going to be another problem for the Israelites, or all of the Middle East, when the Assyrian Empire rises up. And they form the city Ashur, or the city, along with Nineveh and other cities that are coming. And you can see where that's located, kind of between the Tigris and Euphrates River up towards the north. Both the lines of Ham and Shem converged there and probably intermarried and became the Assyrians. The next one, number 3, Arphaxad. And Arphaxad is going to be a direct line or direct ancestor of Abraham and the Israelites. So it goes Shem and then down to Arphaxad. Arphaxad, you can see the way the word ends with the X-A-D. Basically, what that is, they don't know exactly who these people are, but it's a good guess that because of the ending of the words, these are the Chaldean people, and the endings are the same, or the lettering are the same in the different languages. So they think the Arphaxad is those who settled became the Chaldeans. Now, again, this is important because remember, the Chaldeans were the ones who established the city of Ur. Abraham comes from Ur of the Chaldeans. So this would put him in with Arphaxad, which indeed, if you look in chapter 11, he is in the line of the Arphaxad. One of the things that's taken place theologically here, before we hit chapter 12 and we call Abraham, or God calls Abraham out of the nations and separates him, is it's establishing very tightly, very clearly, that every person comes from the same stock. Every person, even the Jews, are the same group of people, and they've been called out. Abraham is coming out of these people. The Israelites or the Hebrews are coming out of these people as a chosen nation, but their origin is the same, right here with all the Gentile nations. And Arphaxad is one of those ancestors that it comes that sets it up. Lud, not much is known about Lud. The Luddites, they're mentioned different places. We don't know for sure where they're at. Also, they're mentioned Ham's line. Aram, like I've already said, is Syria, which is just north of Israel. In fact, there's a country named Syria today. It's that area. They probably settled first, you can see right there, just in the area of Shinar, and probably moved west from there as they were scattered out. You've got Elam probably going south. You've got Joktan going south. You've got Aram moving back into the west. The Assyrians staying where they're at and moving north. Aram comes up several times. This is the people when Abraham sends out his servant to find a wife for his son Isaac. He sends him up. He says, do not take a wife from the Canaanites. I want someone from our family to marry Isaac. They go up to Haran and he finds someone of the Arameans. And it is one of his, from their line of the family there. So the Arameans are very close, really related to Israel or Arphaxad. In fact, in Deuteronomy 26 verse 5, Moses calls Jacob and refers to Jacob in his life as a wandering Aramean. And so even Moses considers them part of the family line. Uz. Now we continue. If we go back down into the Genesis chapter 10, verse 22, we're about done with this. We're moving quickly here. Verse 22 gives you the sons of Shem. Elam, Ashur, Arphaxad, Lud, and Aram. And we kind of got a general idea where they're at. Now the sons of Aram are mentioned. There are four sons of Aram mentioned. Most likely they're going to be close to that area of Aram. Most of those, the last three, Hull and Gether, are probably cities that became cities within the Aramean area. One that is mentioned first is Uz, U-Z, not Oz, U-Z, the land of Uz. And you've heard of the land of Uz, you've heard of the land of Oz too. But the land of Uz, you've heard of that from Job chapter 1, verse 1. Job was from the land or lived in the land of Uz. So this is probably giving an indication. There's two options on this of where these cities are. But if that's the right location, Uz is often located or identified with Edom, which is south. You can see it on your map right there. It is right there by Edom. Edom is south of the Dead Sea. And it says in that there was a land in the east called Uz. In Job chapter 1, verse 1, the land in the east. And Moses would have been writing then from the land of Midian, and that's on the maps there, having come from Egypt. And so Uz would be in that general area near Midian, but in the east. Not far, far away, but just east of them. It's also east of Israel. So that puts Uz right around Edom or Midian, just over that area. There's another Uz that could be up further north in more of the Aramean territory. But either way, this is a mention of Uz, and it could have been where Job had come from. The last one of the sons of Aram is the one mentioned as Meshech, and Meshech is probably in Lebanon or settled up into Asia Minor where Turkey is today. Those are the sons of the Arameans. Now we come down to the next one. It says next, Arphaxad was the father of Shelah, and Shelah was the father of Eber. Two sons were born to Eber. Remember, Eber is the name for Hebrews. And probably that's even ties together with the city of Hebrews. Eber may have settled in that area also and became known. The city became known after them. He's got two sons. Listen here, as we said, Peleg is simply given this. He's given a definition or a little bit of an etymology on his name. I'm going to read verse 25 again. Two sons were born to Eber. One was named Peleg. And that's all it says. There's no descendants listed here. They're coming. But it mentions here the important thing about Peleg, important enough to mention here, was because in his time the earth was divided. And we're going to talk about what that means here in just a moment. But there's basically going to be four ideas that you could get on that, what that means the earth was divided in Peleg's day. But something happened around Peleg's day that caused him to be named what he was named, to have this etymology or an explanation to come with him all the way up to our time. He was named Peleg because it was in his day the earth was divided. Remember? Well, by this time, all we've got is his name and the reference to that huge event, but we have to now decide what that is. Obviously, it may have something to do with chapter 11, where the languages were divided. Let's go ahead and look down here on page 3 and look at some information here about Peleg and talk about this. I will mention as we go past Eber that they have found names, personal names or proper names, from around 2300 BC of being used, the name of Eber being used. Now it's the same guy, but that Eber, actually historically we've got that name recorded. He was one of the kings of Elba. Nonetheless, here we go, page 3 at the bottom, Peleg. The name Peleg in the Hebrew is, we could simply spell it with just the consonants, is the word P-L-G, or Peleg, putting the vowels in. And it's similar sounding to the word which is divided, which is N-P-L-G, if you spell it in English for the Hebrew. So Peleg is very close to the word divided. In fact, it sounds the same, it's got the meaning. This is mentioned a couple of times in Scripture. It is apparently ties together some specific event. And as we go through Scripture, the first place we see is in Psalms chapter 1, verse 3. We won't look at it right now. But in Psalms chapter 1, verse 3, the same word is used in reference to a canal or a stream. In other words, the word for divided is a word that means a canal with water in it or a stream. It means some kind of a division with water. That is the meaning of the word divided. It means a division in the earth with water in it. It means a canal. So in Peleg's day, the earth was divided. It right there, just on the surface, it doesn't mean, languages. It means divided with water in canals. That's the meaning, the etymology of the word. There's another place in Job chapter 38, verse 25, where it refers to the digging of canals for rainwater to be gathered. Once again, the similar word meaning. But in Psalm 55, verse 9, not referring to the Tower of Babel and the confusion of languages, but Psalm 55, verse 9, the word divided is used that David is praying that God would divide or confuse the speech of the wicked. Now it's getting very close to the Tower of Babel in chapter 11. It's not a reference. It's just basically David pronouncing or praying for a curse, if you would, on the wicked people that there will. I've got it written down right here. Here's what it says in Psalm 55, verse 9. Confuse the wicked, or divide the wicked, O Lord, confound their speech, for I see violence, or Hamas, and strife in the city. David's talking about his day. David's seeing situations, he says, confuse them, divide them, take their speech and get it confused. Maybe even referring in his mind, thinking about the days of Babel, when God confused the ancient city of Babel by confusing languages. Maybe he's referring to that also. So there is just an interesting use of that word in reference to language, not in the same reference, but again in the same type of a context. Now, one other thing about this, and that's point F on your notes, is in chapter 11, when we start talking about the Tower of Babel, God is going to come and scatter the people. He's not going to divide them like a canal with water in it. It's two different words. So in other words, I'm not saying you can't. I'm just saying it's just as easy to say this division was a water canal or water separating the land as it is to say God was dividing languages and divided the people with languages. Because in Genesis chapter 11, it doesn't say he divided. It says he scattered. It's a completely different word. Again, the ideal is the same, but there's just not that easy connection right into chapter 11, meaning there may be something more going on here. So again, there's no for sure to hear. And I've got that written down. Those two words are in point F. The word earth refers to land and can be translated that way. So when it says over here, in his time the earth was divided, that is not a reference to the world, the people, the system being divided. It's a reference to the land that you're walking on where water runs. In his day, the land was divided as canals. So it's right there, the land and canals, and there was a division that was caused by it. So what does this all mean? These are the options, beginning on point L right there, I. This event clearly involves a division of the land or the people. Something's happening. In Peleg's day, something happened. And it probably wasn't in Peleg's day, like during his lifetime. It was probably at the time of his birth or around that time this event was taking place to cause Eber to name his son after that event. So in his day, when he was being named, Eber says this is it. Now here's what could take place. Number one, it could refer to the first thing, the division of the people at Tower of Babel. Absolutely, no doubt about it. That could be the reference. that in his day, it was during Peleg's younger days, or when he was being born, that the earth was being scattered because of this infusion of the confusion of languages by God. And it would be, like we said last week or the week before, it would be the fourth generation after the flood. The fourth generation, as we come through the line of Nimrod, that they are now at the place where God is going to scatter them, the fourth generation, part of the judgment. So it could be referring to that. No doubt about it. That's a good choice. The simplest way of explaining it is just like that. This is a reference to chapter 11 of the Tower of Babel. Doesn't fit perfectly with the words, but it's not that far off either. The second one, the one I like, is that this is a reference to the earthquakes or something, the separating of the land masses, meaning God is doing, in my idea, again, this is not a dogmatic statement, this is not a point of doctrine, but as God comes down and confuses the languages, not only is he confusing the languages, he's also moving them apart continentally or moving the land masses apart so they can't get to each other. Because soon as the languages are divided, if they're still living in the same area, they're going to start to unite again. It's going to start a breakdown. You can see it taking place even today as we start trying to melt cultures together. So in other words, he would have then separated the people with some kind of water barriers or canals that would separate. And now, of course, you're going to have continental plates moving, which is earthquakes of some sort, which is not hard to imagine because that's how the flood started. This would be taking place just a few generations after the flood, which means everything's still probably unstable and settling out. It could very easily be part of it, especially when you look at the earthquakes we've got happening now. And as Jesus Christ, his return gets closer, there's going to be more and more earthquakes. And so finally, when he does return on the land of on the Mount of Olives, huge earthquake that the whole earth is going to experience. Oh, there's another one that we could talk about in Ezekiel 37, 38, an earthquake that the whole world is going to experience. So again, it's not like far-fetched, well, that's ridiculous. It's not ridiculous. It's probable or possible, at least. I like that idea. It's more exciting than any of the other ones. Number three, the separation that could have taken place was this right here, what we've already referred to. In Eber's day, or Peleg's day, they went two directions. The people, some went to Babylon, and Peleg separated from them, and he is going to become the forefather of Abraham and the father of faith. In other words, it may have been a separating of the people. He would have separated from the rest of the line of Shem. Or the last idea there is Peleg could have been a guy who did nothing more, not that it's nothing more, but he introduced to or popularized the ideal of, very simple, digging canals and irrigating the fields. And in Peleg's day, we started irrigating. And that's what that could be saying. I mean, that's exactly what it could be. It may not even be a reference to dividing people. So it could be the division of language. It could be the division of the land masses. It could be a division of the people groups of one line of Eber going this way and Peleg saying, not at all, we're going this way. And they separated from their own family and says, we're going to do it a different way. Or it could be that Peleg was the one who organized the canal systems. Nonetheless, there you've got it. That is that phrase right there. Two sons were born to Eber. One was named Peleg because in his time the earth was divided, or the land was divided. His brother's name was Joktan. Joktan was the father, and now we shoot off 13 names. And I've got those listed right there on page 4, the 13 names. And basically as you go through that, it's very simply defined this way. They went into the Arabian area. They went into Saudi Arabia. They went to Yemen. Someone went down to southeast Yemen. Some went to southwest of Saudi Arabia and the Yemen. Some went to the east of Yemen. In that area, they're down by Mecca. They're down by Medina. They're settling that area there. They became those people in that area. So that's what you've got right there, and that is the people groups coming out of Shem. Just interesting now, you've got the mixture of all these people of where you've got Ham, Shem, and Japheth on your maps. And we begin now with chapter 11 explaining how this happened. Most commentators, I think everybody pretty much is in alignment with the idea that chapter 11 happened before the division of chapter 10. But chapter 10 is a description of where the people went. Chapter 11 is an explanation of why they went. And what is interesting about that's important, and we see it throughout Scripture, is God's got a plan. God's got a plan to bless man and give man good. Now let's look at this list right up here. This is important. God's plan is to bless man and give him good things. That is God's nature. That is why God created man. That is what God does in the Garden of Eden. He creates man with the purpose of blessing him and gives him good things. It was a perfect world. He didn't give him a broken world. He didn't give him a problem. He gave him blessing and had good things planned for him. But what happened? In the garden, man, in a sense, didn't trust God. Man, in a sense, wanted to pursue his own good, and he didn't think God had his best interest in mind, and so man went ahead and ate from the tree. That was a problem. And that sums up human history. God, whatever religion says, whatever religion tries to come across to you, the truth is, the bottom line, the nature of God is He wants to bless you and give you good things. That, and when we get to eternity, when we cross over and this age is done, sin is dealt with and evil is removed, and there is, we go to what it says in Peter talks about it, the home of righteousness, where there is nothing that is sin has been obliterated, it's gone. What will it be like? We will be blessed, and God will continually be giving us good things. The problem on this side of history is humanity doesn't trust God. And when God blesses them and does good things for them, they go, I have another idea. I don't think that is good. I'm going to go about it a different way. When Adam and Eve sinned and decided they wanted to do their own good, they had to move out of Eden, and they moved which direction do they move? East. Now, I'm not, which way is east? Point at east in here. Which way is east? Okay. I don't know. That's why I asked. That wasn't a trick question. It's like, I don't know. They moved east. Okay? They left Eden and moved east. They didn't want to live in the land of blessing where God was giving them good things. They had to move east. Well, Cain kills Abel. And where does Cain move? He moves east again. So people are always moving from the land of blessing where God is giving them good things. They move east. They move east. They're moving away from the good things that God's got for them. Why? Because they don't trust God. God came to Cain. God came to Cain and says, hey, no, there's something wrong. If you'll do what is right, I've got good things for you. Come over here and walk in my ways. I've got good things for you. Cain wouldn't. Killed Abel. Moved east. Chapter 11, verse 1. Are you ready? Now the whole world had one language and a common speech. As men moved eastward, they found a plain in Shinar and settled there. They said to one another, come, let's make bricks and bake them thoroughly. They used brick instead of stone and tar for mortar. Then they said, come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens so that we may make a name for ourselves and not be scattered over the face of the whole earth. Not only do they have a plan on what they're doing, they have a direction they're going. They have a direction they're not going to go in. They are not going to do what? They are not going to be scattered over the surface of the earth. God has created the earth for man. He told Adam, and then he repeated it with Noah. Fill the earth, populate it, subdue it, it's yours, get out there and take it. The men says, we are not going to be scattered. That was God's plan. Go to the land, I'm going to bless you and give you good things when you get there. Go. They said, no, we're not. We're going to stay. We're going to build our own city. We've got a plan. They didn't want the land of blessing. They didn't want the good things. They wanted their own plan. They wanted their own good things. They didn't trust God's definition of good. They says, hey, this is what we want. And so guess what? What they do right here in chapter 1, verse 1, it says, or verse 2, as men moved eastward. And we're in chapter 11 of Genesis. I know it's taken us probably about a year to get there. But as we look at this, throughout our story so far, whenever you see people moving to live in the land of the east, moving further east, it's an indication here so far that they're moving away from the land, they're moving away from God's goodness or the things God's got planned. Chapter 12, look in verse 1. This is coming up in a few months. The Lord had said to Abram, leave your country. Now where does Abram live? Ur of the Chaldeans. He's living in the land of Babel. He's living in that land. They were settled. Listen, if they moved eastward, That means they had come from the westward side. Because you remember Mount Ararat was up north, and they came down and settled, but they must have drifted over to the west somehow and decided, we're moving east. Well, Abraham is living in Ur of the Chaldeans, which is Babylon. Watch what God says. Leave your country, your people, and your father's household, and go to the land I will show you. Well, where is that land that he's going to be shown at? It's back in the west. He's trying to get him to go back, and Abraham is going to be taken back where everybody left the land to move east and reject God's plan. God takes Abraham and says, no, I want you over here, and takes him back to the west. And Abraham simply, it says in Hebrews, didn't know where he was going, but obeyed and followed. Wasn't sure what God's plan for him was. Now, let's go back to chapter 11, verse 1. Again, we've got the account here between the battle between Babel and God, the word, world and faith, Iraq or Babylon and Jerusalem. There are some word plays here, several word plays. I'm going to see if I can explain them to you. Chapter 11, verse 3. They say, come, let's make bricks. In verse 4, they say, come, let us build ourselves a city. Now, this is even more clever in the Hebrew. But they say, come, let's make bricks. Come, let us make or build ourselves a city. Look in verse 7, what God says. Come, let us go down and confuse their language. They say, come, let us make bricks. Come, let ourselves build a city. God says to his group, come, let's go confuse them. And it's the same wording in the Hebrew. It's like, they say, come, let's do this. God says, okay, come, let's go stop them. And because he's not going to let it take, he's going to make sure his plan is taken care of. Some other words right here. The word fame or name in chapter verse 4 and 9. It's not in the NIV. NIV doesn't carry it over. But the word fame and name is in both of them. In one case, it's let us make ourselves a name. In verse 9, it's like, no, God gave them a different name. They want to make themselves, listen, this is clever. This is so clever. I'm trying to do a good job with these verses here. It's a short 9 verses, but it's so jam-packed that whenever you think of Babylon or this area throughout the Bible, Babylon keeps coming up. And even today, we're over in the area of Babylon. Whenever you think of this, you cannot separate yourself from it because God has forced himself into the story. The name Babel is going to be, it's going to be replaced with confusion. They say, let us make ourselves a name. All right? God says, we call the place Babel. Your name, we want to become a great name. No one will ever forget us. God says, by the end, it says, there you go. You'll never be forgotten. Your name is confusion. Babel. They did exactly what they want to be known forever. God made them known forever. Another place is the word place is used in chapter 2, 7, 8, going back and forth, and heaven. One of the most ironic things, let's see if we can find this here. Verse 4. Then they said, come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower, get this, that reaches to the heavens so that we may make a name for ourselves. That reaches to the heavens. We are going to reach into the heavens. We're going to be known around the world. We're going to be known forever. We're going to the heavens. Well, then you see over here, he says, verse 7 again, come, let us go down and confuse their language. In other words, they says we will go to heaven, and when God hears about it, guess what? God says, no, I'm coming down to you. So they wanted to go up, but instead, God is coming down. You got, the irony of the story taking place right there. Chapter 11, verse 1. Now the whole world was one language. The phrase whole world can be translated the whole land or the whole area was one language. Let's see what we got coming up here next. Let me see, got any notes here very quickly. Let's go back and read through this. Here we go. Chapter 11, verse 1. Now the whole world had one language and a common speech. Linguists, people who study linguistics, they are trying or have tried for years to take this back to there's one original language. You know, just everything evolved out of one language. And that would be so neat if that happened right here. But you understand what that would mean? They haven't done it that way yet. At least one line of thinking is the languages, they can't connect all the language to one single point. And we say, well, we would really like that to happen here. But you realize if they do, they could take it all the way back to some ancient caveman 4 billion years ago who started to grunt one day. And all the language developed from that one place. You could actually trace, just like you have a one-cell organism, okay, with me? And all the life came from that one cell organism. They trace it all back to that one point. Everything's got to go back to one point, if it be biological evolution or linguistic evolution. But they can't trace everything back to one language. Which at first, they all had one language. Right, that would be true if language, if you think of this as just a story or a fable to account that eventually then the north side started talking different than the south side, the east side got a different dialect than the west side, and pretty soon they just split apart, and through several centuries or generations, the languages spread apart. But what takes place in history is the languages are not connected at an original point, which is interesting because that would give credence to this story. That one day, God comes down, visits the city, and says, this is not good, and confuse the language. Not let them all just drift into different dialects of the same language, like Texan English and New York English, but completely revamp their thinking and reprogram their mind so they're speaking something completely different. And thus, we may have traced this even in our own linguistic studies as we go through this. Now, the whole world had one language and a common speech. So again, they had the same word bank, they had the same dialect, they're the same, those are two words, had the same language, word or speech, and common speech, that means the same word bank, same selection of words. As men moving eastward, they found a plain in Shinar and settled there. Instead of filled the earth, they stopped there. They said to each other, come, let's make bricks. Now, they're going to build themselves a city, and one of the problems, if we flipped over to Revelation chapter 18 and read about it in there, we could see it even in its full state, is this had to be a very difficult city to live in. The oppression had, this wasn't the United States of America where there's, you know, all these rights and lawyers and everything, everybody getting their fair share. This would be a land of oppression, where the leaders became lords and the laborers became slaves. Slavery here, I mean, you've got to just get that, this thing develop a little bit in your mind. This had to be one ugly place, depending on which side of the scale you fell on. The laborers had to be, when they say, come, let us do this, that's probably the leaders talking, come, let's begin this oppression. It's going to be a system that you're not going to be able to break out of. When you read Revelation 18, you're going to find in Revelation throughout there, in the city of Babylon, it talks about even the souls of men are being sold. I mean, they're buying and selling people. They're not just buying and selling, you know, cinnamon and wood projects and different things that are listed there. They're selling people. And that's got to be where this was at. God comes down and looks at it. This is not what he's got intended. You realize if people would have spread out, get yourself away. Get out there in the open country. Find your place. Develop it. Have your own spot on the earth. But instead, they were afraid, just like the Israelites when the tribes came in and had to conquer the land. For example, the tribe of Dan didn't want to fight, so they moved off somewhere else. We don't want the land of blessing. We want to go somewhere else. These people says, no, let's live here. Now watch, it backfired probably on many of them. Thousands of them, it backfired. We're going to stay here where we've got the benefit of society. Well, that society then began to move in on them, enslaves them, and now they're basically forced labor with a few people having, again, all the benefits. It ends up here as you go through some other records, you look at it, well, even as you look at history, it's going to end up with human sacrifices. They're going to be offering humans possibly on this ziggurat as human sacrifices to the gods that they decided to worship. So in other words, when they say, let us settle there, you don't want to do that. Don't settle anywhere. You make sure you obey God. And he says, go off and subdue. Go off and subdue. It's like, that sounds like a lot more work, a lot more risk, have to face chaos and all the obstacles that are built into the system. Well, it's like it's better to be there in the land of blessing, getting the good things from God, than trying to find your own goodness. And here they are trying to find their own goodness. And where do they end up? In this situation, it's probably going to involve a lot of slavery, a lot of oppression. Come, let's make bricks and bake them thoroughly. Now, the reason this is being explained possibly is because in the land of Israel, and we saw it last year, even today, everything's made out of stone. They're not baking bricks. They're just using stone. They're quarrying stone, just building things out of stone. Beautiful buildings, but it's all out of stone. These people over here didn't have the option of stone and quarries, so they had to make some kind of bricks. First, they would make mud bricks, put them together with some kind of substance, where now their technology, they used brick instead of stone, meaning they're going to make them their own shapes, their own way, their man-made substance, and use tar for mortar, which is going to make it longer-lasting, waterproof. It's an improvement on what was going on currently at the time. So they're going to make this so they can build higher, taller, better buildings. Now, even the wordplay here, you may not appreciate it because I haven't done a good job of this, but there's several wordplays in here. Here's one here. Tar for mortar in the Hebrew, it would be hemar for Homer. Tar for mortar, hemar for Homer. And that's just it. The whole idea here in these nine verses, again, I need to do a better job of this, but there's rhyming going on and wordplays going on, so that words are, you change one letter in the word, it means a different thing. And here it comes up after all of them so far. They come here, hemar for Homer. And so it's another wordplay. Then they said, come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens, so that we may make a name for ourselves, that we may be famous. And you can see this throughout history, even at, you know, going back to this time. The ziggurats, some of the ziggurats are still known on who built them, the king who built them. The pyramids, a classic example, are still here. A name for themselves. And not be scattered over the face of the whole earth. In other words, that image of the whole earth today, we think about, wow, wouldn't you like to live in this city or this country or go over here and visit this land or something, this some kind of site. In this case, that whole earth, it was a dangerous place. I mean, it was chaotic. It was unsettled. I mean, it had come back after the flood. Stuff had started growing. The animals had started multiplying. And we don't know what's out there. And to go out there was running a risk. But God says, I want you out there. Well, they didn't want to go out to the whole earth. But the Lord came down to see the city and the tower. Notice what he's looking at. The city and the tower that the men were building. The Lord said, now this is an important statement. And I don't think it's sarcastic. I think it's a description of what God is doing. I think it's a description. You keep this in your mind. Think about this. I think this is a description of how powerful God has made mankind. And I mean that. We are powerful. We do have forces within us of creativity and ability and ingenuity, especially in a situation like this. They have one language and a collective source of information. You understand what I'm saying? Everybody that is anybody with any kind of thinking ability, anybody with any kind of skill, anybody with any kind of financial resources are all focused together, speaking the same language, with the same culture, celebrating the same holidays, with the same family background, with the same goal. And all the information is all collected on one purpose. Just think if our country were to say, we're going to solve our energy crisis. We're going to solve our dependence on gasoline or oil dependence on foreign countries. Well, what would happen? If the Republicans suggested it, the Democrats would say, well, that's a stupid idea. We'll never be able to do that. But if next week the Democrats suggested it, the same Republicans would say, well, you know, that's not going to work, and you're just doing that for someone. They would never work together. Imagine the United States of America with this right here. One language, one word bank, one goal, all of our energies, no matter of race, creed, whatever, all together with one goal. Everybody's not talking against each other. They're just elevating each other's ideas. So if a Democrat comes up with an idea, the Republican says, that's not a bad idea, but if we would add this to that, that would be a greater idea. And the Democrat says, wow, that's a good idea. We'll bring this group in here and we'll really make it good. And we'll get it done by next weekend. Don't you think that would happen? But instead, we're going to argue about it forever and destroy ourselves. Babel is still happening. But notice right here what God says. And I think this is a positive statement that he realizes. The Lord said in verse 6, Yahweh, that's Yahweh. Yahweh said, if as one people, speaking the same language, they have begun to do this, then nothing they plan to do will be impossible for them. And thus, God is going to confuse them. He says, oh, no. Humanity, in their, the Greeks called it hubris. It's a word that means, the word is hubris. It means outrageous arrogance. If people have separated themselves from God, and in their arrogance, their outrageous arrogance, they think they can make a plan that is going to come against my plan or against me, God says. He says, it's going to be done. And mankind, and you can go through empires, and watch great worlds, great empires, great people groups take that step into what the Greeks called hubris, which was outrageous arrogance. The thought that whatever I want, I can accomplish. Whatever I plan to do, I will do it. And even if there's warning signs saying, don't go there, don't do that, their hubris will take them to that place, and that hubris, that outrageous arrogance, is what defeats them and ends up bringing down their own careers, sometimes their own empires. And there's historical examples throughout of men, and men who went too far, leaders who pushed it over the edge. The greatest man, and they go through all the philosophers and all the way through history, of people standing there warning them, is the great man is the one who controls the hubris. You don't go where these people go. You don't go to the place that you think anything you do, anything you want, you can do. Realize you've got limitations. And if you try to exceed those limitations, again, now we're talking about what the Greeks believed, the Greeks felt the gods would come and affect or strike or confuse those who were in hubris. And once you entered into outrageous arrogance of anything I want to do, I will be able to do it, overrating yourself, even considering yourself on the basis of a god, that you are now ready for destruction. Pride cometh before a fall type of thing. And this is an example of hubris. We ourselves as a nation, we need to look out for hubris, thinking that we can do certain things. There's certain things that we cannot do. God has set limits on people, on empires, on nations. There's certain things you can't go to. And He will see, because if He allows hubris to run its full course, anything man wants to do, He has the ability to do it. Look what God says. If as one people, speaking the same language, they have begun to do this, then nothing they plan to do will be impossible for them. This outrageous arrogance, this outrageous sin nature, combined with the potential that God has put inside of humanity, is going to lead them to the place they can do anything they want, but it will be against God's plan. He says, we've got to now stop this. I've got to confuse this so they cannot unite against my plan, that they'll be slowed down. Now, here we go. He says nothing will be impossible for them. Again, just a side note there. On the good side, if we would unite under God for a worthy purpose, the same thing would be true, especially if God would come along with that and bless it. Come, let us go down and confuse their language so they will not understand each other. So the Lord scattered them from there over the earth, and they stopped building the city. That is why it was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of the whole world. Notice right there, it was called Babel. They wanted a great name. The name of the city was Babel. This is one letter off. Babel, it's now confusion. There the Lord confused the language of the whole earth. From there the Lord scattered them over the face of the whole earth. And again, that sets up the stage now. That is mankind in rebellion towards God. But now we continue now, next week, we continue in chapter 11, verse 10, picking up the account of Shem going, oh, but wait, we forgot to continue the line of Peleg. Peleg, or line of Arphaxad through Shem. It goes through there, and you're going to end up with the story of Terah. And before we begin the story of Abraham, we've got to figure out who Terah was, because that he's got something going on in his life there, in beginning in verse 27. Notice in chapter 11, verse 27, what you expected to say in verse 27, the Toledot formula, this is the account, or this is the written document. Well, who are we going to talk about? We're going to talk about Abraham, or Abram. We would want that. We would expect them to say, now this is the written account. This is the document of Abraham. But it doesn't. It says, this is the account of Terah. And then it starts talking about Abraham. It's like, well, who's Terah? And why has he got his own written document here? And what is going on? We'll have to pick that up next time. Thank you for listening. I hope it's useful for you. We'll pray and we'll be out of here. Father, we do thank you so much for your word. We thank you for the chance to study. I do ask that we would look into these things, that we would study them. But Father, we do ask that we take warning from that. One, to realize that there is unity as we work together as people on a common good, but also, Father, to realize that there is those, including our own selves, that cross the line and will enter into that area of hubris, or will enter an area of trying to get our own good and rejecting your good. Father, we do not want to live in the land of the East and move away from Eden, but Father, we want to live in the land that you brought us to. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.